You know, navigating the relationship between science and religion can feel like stepping into a minefield, really. Mm-hmm. Lots of complex and often hotly debated questions.
Absolutely. Yeah. And in this deep dive, we're tackling a really central question within that territory. Is science fundamentally a threat to theism? And can our religious beliefs truly align with what we understand through scientific discovery?
Hmm.
Our guide for this exploration is Dr. Jim Spiegel, specifically his insights from Session 14 of his Philosophy of Religion series, focusing on theism and science.
Exactly. So our mission for you today is to really get under the skin of how people have tried to make sense of this connection or, you know, this perceived mm-hmm. conflict.
Yeah.
We want to move way beyond the simplistic idea that it's an either situation mm-hmm. and hopefully uncover some surprising and, well, more nuanced perspectives.
Definitely.
Now, Dr. Spiegel kicks things off by highlighting a couple of, let's say, problematic ways of thinking about this. And I think it's crucial for us to address those right away. First up is scientism, sometimes called positivism. Okay, let's break this down quickly.
Okay.
This is the view that the only genuine knowledge we can possess must come from science mm-hmm. or be scientifically verifiable. If science can't test it, it's just not real knowledge.
Right. And what's fascinating right off the bat is that this viewpoint kind of trips over its own feet. Can you actually use the scientific method to prove that all knowledge must be scientifically proven?
No.
The statement itself isn't something you can put under a microscope or run an experiment on, so it fails its own test for validity. It's a logical dead end, really.
Precisely. It's like saying the only words that exist are words with three syllables. Well, three syllables doesn't have three syllables, so the whole thing just collapses.
Uh-huh. Good analogy.
The second tricky perspective is the God of the gaps. What's the core idea there?
The God of the gaps idea is basically that religion, specifically belief in God, fills in the blanks in our scientific understanding. So, you know, whenever science can't explain something, that's where God steps in. The problem, of course, is that as science advances and those gaps in our knowledge get filled, the space for God seems to shrink.
Right, right. And here's where it gets really interesting. Dr. Spiegel nails the fundamental flaw here.
Hmm.
It assumes that something can't have both a scientific explanation and a theological significance.
Exactly.
It sets up this unnecessary battle where if science explains it, God can't be involved and vice versa.
Exactly. It creates this artificial competition. So having cleared those problematic viewpoints off the table, Dr. Spiegel introduces three main models for understanding how science and theology relate. The first is the conflict thesis.
Okay, the conflict thesis, this is the straightforward science versus religion idea, right? They're fundamentally opposed, and you have to pick a side. You can't be both a scientifically minded person and a person of faith.
That's the gist of it, yeah. And proponents often point to historical flashpoints as evidence. You know, the Galileo affair where the church resisted the idea of a sun-centered solar system,
right.
Or the 19th century debates around Darwin's theory of evolution. Those are prime examples used to show this inherent conflict with science ultimately being proven correct.
And those were definitely major clashes, no doubt. But Dr. Spiegel makes a really key point. He says that just because scientific theories sometimes butt heads with theological interpretations, it doesn't automatically mean that the actual truth about the world contradicts biblical teachings.
Mm.
He reminds us that both science and theology involve interpreting data, the data of the natural world, and the data of Scripture. And sometimes our interpretations, our attempts to understand that data, might be where the conflict arises, not in the underlying realities themselves.
That's such a crucial distinction.
Yeah.
The friction might be in our human attempts to understand and our theoretical frameworks rather than an actual contradiction between the physical world and what's revealed.
Makes sense.
So the second model Dr. Spiegel presents is the independence thesis.
Independence. Okay, so this is the idea that science and religion exist in totally separate zones, right? They have their own subject matter and methods and can never really overlap or interfere with each other.
Precisely. Stephen Jay Gould famously championed this with his concept of non-overlapping magisteria, or noma.
Ah, yes, noma.
The idea is that science deals with the natural world, the how things work, while religion and theology deal with the realm of meaning, values, and the spiritual, the why. Because they're addressing entirely different sets of questions, they can't truly be in conflict.
That sounds nice and clean, but Dr. Spiegel highlights a pretty significant issue with this separation, doesn't he?
It does.
The simple fact is that Scripture does address topics that science also investigates. I mean, think about the origins of the universe, the nature of humanity, the development of life, even historical events like a global flood potentially. There's clearly some shared...
Exactly. So the idea of completely non-overlapping domains doesn't quite fit the reality of the content of religious texts and the scope of scientific inquiry. Which brings us to the third model. And this is the one Dr. Spiegel himself finds most compelling, the interactive model.
Okay, interactive. This suggests a relationship where they can both engage with and potentially learn from each other.
Yeah.
How does this model envision the connection?
Well, the interactive model sees science and theology as distinct but potentially interconnected ways of engaging with the same reality. It acknowledges that disagreements can surface primarily at the level of our theories, scientific theories interpreting the natural world, and theological frameworks interpreting scripture.
Okay.
However, it also posits that at the level of fundamental truths, there shouldn't be an ultimate contradiction.
So when these theoretical clashes do happen, what's the way forward? How do we determine if one needs to be reevaluated?
This is where the interactive part really shines. Dr. Spiegel stresses that we need to tackle these issues individually, case by case. We need to consider all the evidence available to us, be careful about the conclusions we draw on both the scientific and theological sides, and crucially, be open to the possibility that either perspective might need to be revised in light of the other.
Mutual correction.
Exactly. This willingness to mutual correction is key. It could even lead to completely new insights, new ways of understanding things within either science or theology, new paradigms even.
Speaking of new ways of understanding, this is where the ideas of Thomas Kuhn become really relevant, right? His work really changed how we see the process of science itself and how that impacts its relationship with religion.
Absolutely. Kuhn's groundbreaking work, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, really challenged the traditional picture of science as this purely objective and neutral pursuit of truth.
Yeah, it shook things up.
Definitely. Dr. Spiegel highlights two key insights from Kuhn that are particularly relevant to our discussion. The first is that scientific inquiry isn't neutral. All observation is theory-laden.
Okay, theory-laden. What does that practically mean for how scientists view the world and conduct their work?
Essentially, the existing theories we hold, our current understanding of how the world works, actually influence how we perceive and interpret what we observe. Kuhn introduced the idea of a paradigm, which is kind of the dominant theoretical framework in a given scientific field.
Right, the model everyone's working within.
Exactly. Think back to the debate between a geocentric, you know, Earth-centered and heliocentric, sun-centered solar system. Someone who believed the Earth was the center literally saw the sun moving across the sky as direct proof. While someone who believed the sun was the center interpreted that exact same observation as the Earth rotating. They were looking at the same thing, but seeing it through completely different theoretical lenses, different paradigms.
That makes perfect sense. Yep. It's like that duck-rabbit illusion Dr. Spiegel mentioned. What you expect to see a duck or a rabbit influences how your brain interprets those ambiguous lines. Our existing ideas shape our interpretations.
Precisely. And this isn't just a minor point. It's a fundamental aspect of how we make sense of the world, even in the supposedly objective realm of science. Kuhn's second key insight is that scientific theories are underdetermined by the data.
Underdetermined. So what does that tell us about how scientific theories are developed and ultimately chosen?
It means that the raw data alone doesn't force us to accept one single inevitable theory. There can be multiple different theories that are all consistent with the available evidence.
So how do scientists choose them?
Well, Kuhn argued that factors beyond strict logical deduction come into play. Things like how well the theory explains things, its simplicity or elegance, and even its perceived beauty.
Beauty in a scientific theory. That sounds a little unexpected.
It does, but think about it. A theory that can explain a wide range of phenomena with just a few elegant principles often feels more compelling than a complicated, messy one, right?
I suppose so, yeah.
Dr. Spiegel even recounts the famous story of Kekule and his dream of a snake biting its own tail, which supposedly led to the discovery of the ring structure of benzene.
Ah, the snake dream.
Yeah. It highlights that scientific discovery isn't always a purely linear, rational process. There's often a role for imagination and intuition. The accidental discovery of X-rays is another great example of how breakthroughs can happen in unforeseen ways. Even Einstein emphasized the importance of, like, aesthetic qualities in evaluating competing theories.
So it's not just about the cold, hard facts. There's a degree of interpretation and maybe even intuition involved in the development and acceptance of scientific theories.
For sure.
This naturally leads us to the whole concept of the presuppositions of science, doesn't it? The underlying assumptions that science itself relies upon.
Absolutely. Dr. Spiegel points out that science doesn't operate in a vacuum. It rests on certain fundamental assumptions, foundational beliefs that we accept as true, even if we can't scientifically prove them within the scientific framework itself.
Okay, like what?
Well, one crucial assumption is the general reliability of our senses. We have to trust that what we see, hear, and touch generally corresponds to reality.
And you can't use your senses to scientifically prove that your senses are reliable without already assuming their reliability in the process. It's another one of those self-referential situations.
Exactly. You got it. Other key presuppositions include the law of causality, the idea that every effect has a cause, the uniformity of nature.
Meaning
the belief that the fundamental laws governing the universe will remain consistent over time and across space. And, of course, the reliability of logic itself.
Right. Foundational stuff.
Totally. These are all foundational assumptions that are absolutely necessary to even begin doing science. This is a core reason why scientism, the idea that science can prove everything, ultimately falls short. Science itself is built on a foundation of things it cannot prove scientifically.
So, while science has achieved incredible things, transforming our world through medicine, technology, communication, all of it.
Mm-hmm.
It does operate within certain boundaries and based on these, well, unprovable assumptions.
Precisely.
Now, this raises the question of whether theological considerations should have any place in scientific methodology. This seems to be a point of ongoing discussion.
It certainly is. Dr. Spiegel makes a useful distinction here between metaphysical naturalism and methodological naturalism.
Okay, break those down.
So metaphysical naturalism is the philosophical belief that only the physical world exists. Full stop. Nothing supernatural.
Got it.
Methodological naturalism, on the other hand, is more of a practical approach in science. It's the idea that science, as a method, should only refer to natural phenomena and its explanations, regardless of what you personally believe exists.
Okay. So you could believe in God, but still practice methodological naturalism in your lab work.
Exactly. It's important to realize that someone can be a methodological naturalist in their scientific work and still hold theistic beliefs in their personal life. They believe in God, but think that scientific explanations should stick to natural causes.
Interesting distinction. What are some of the key arguments for this methodological naturalism? Why do some people, even those who are religious, argue for keeping theological explanations separate from scientific ones?
Well, one common argument is that the very goal of science is to explain natural phenomena in terms of other natural phenomena. Appealing to supernatural causes, from this perspective, is seen as abandoning the scientific endeavor. It's like cheating in a game if you can't figure out the natural rules, as Dr. Spiegel's student analogy illustrated with football.
Right, invoking a miracle past completion.
Exactly. The idea is that science should always strive to find natural explanations, and invoking the supernatural kind of short circuits that process. Another argument, sometimes called functional integrity, suggests that God created the physical world to be self-sufficient, operating through natural laws without requiring constant supernatural intervention to explain events.
Okay, like a clockmaker who winds it up and lets it run.
Sort of, yeah. That's the idea.
But Dr. Spiegel offers some thought-provoking counterpoints to these arguments, doesn't he?
He does. Regarding the cheating analogy, he basically asks, well, who gets to define the boundaries of legitimate scientific inquiry? Why is it automatically considered unscientific to even consider the possibility of a non-natural cause for certain phenomena?
Good question.
He also reminds us that many of the key figures in the development of modern science, Newton, Kepler, Boyle, many others, were themselves deeply religious individuals who saw no inherent conflict in integrating their theological understanding with their scientific investigations.
That's true.
And as for the functional integrity argument, Dr. Spiegel points out the inherent irony that this argument itself relies on a theological assumption, the idea that God designed the world in a specific way to be self-sufficient.
Yeah, that is ironic.
He also emphasizes that the laws of nature are descriptive, not explanatory in themselves. They describe consistent patterns like the inverse square law for gravity or nuclear forces or thermodynamics, but they don't actually explain why those patterns exist in the first place. They need explaining themselves.
So if methodological naturalism has its limitations, what alternative does Dr. Spiegel explore?
The alternative is often referred to as theistic science. This is an approach that explicitly allows for theological considerations to potentially inform scientific inquiry. Thinkers like Alvin Plantinga and those involved in the intelligent design movement are often seen as proponents of this view. The argument here is basically, look, if other academic disciplines like history or sociology can draw insights and data from science, why shouldn't science, in certain circumstances, be open to insights from theology or philosophy? Why is it only a one-way street?
Interesting point. Interdisciplinarity. And intelligent design theory is presented as an example of this, focusing on aspects like the fine-tuning of the universe.
Right, the constants of physics being just right for life.
And the complexity of biological systems as potential indicators of an unnatural cause.
Exactly. Concepts like irreducible complexity in biological systems, the idea that some systems require multiple interacting parts to function at all, and supposedly couldn't have evolved through gradual, step-by-step Darwinian processes, are often cited by those advocating for theistic science as evidence pointing towards supernatural causation. Think of the complexity of DNA and RNA interaction, for instance.
Right. This all kind of culminates in the perspective of Alvin Plantinga and his book, Where the Conflict Really Lies.
Mm.
What's his central argument regarding science, theism, and naturalism?
Plantinga's central thesis is quite surprising, really provocative. He argues that the conflict we often perceive between science and theistic religion is actually superficial, while there's a deep and often unacknowledged harmony or concord between them.
Okay.
Conversely, he argues that while there might appear to be a superficial agreement between science and naturalism, a much more profound conflict actually exists there.
Wow. That's a real twist. So where does he see this fundamental conflict between science and naturalism arising?
Well, one of his primary arguments revolves around the reliability of our cognitive faculties, basically, our ability to think and form true beliefs about the world. Science fundamentally relies on the assumption that our minds are capable of understanding the universe and producing accurate knowledge, right?
Yep.
Obviously. But Plantinga argues that naturalism, particularly when combined with the theory of evolution by natural selection, struggles to provide a convincing account for this reliability.
How so?
Well, if our cognitive abilities are solely the product of a process that favors survival and reproduction, there's no guarantee that they would be aimed at truth. False beliefs can be just as conducive to survival as true ones.
Give me an example.
He uses his well-known example of, say, someone taking out a risky mortgage. They might irrationally believe housing prices will never go down. That's a false belief. But if it leads them to take actions that, by chance, help them survive economically in the short term, the belief, though false, had survival value. Natural selection cares about survival behavior, not necessarily true beliefs.
That's a really insightful point. A belief doesn't need to be true to help you survive and pass on your genes. It just needs to lead to behaviors that enhance your chances.
Exactly. Theism, on the other hand, offers a straightforward explanation for the general reliability of our cognitive faculties. If humans were created by a god who, say, made us in his image and intended for them to understand the world he created, then it makes sense that our minds would be generally oriented towards truth.
Okay.
This, according to Plantinga, is a significant point of alignment or concord between science and theism. Science needs reliable minds, and theism provides a reason why we might have them.
Interesting. What else?
He also points to the uniformity of nature as another area of tension between science and naturalism. Naturalism, he contends, provides no ultimate justification for our confidence that the fundamental laws of nature will remain consistent. Why should they? It's just how things happen to be, maybe.
Yeah.
That consistency is a bedrock assumption for all scientific inquiry.
But theism?
Theism, with its belief in a consistent and orderly creator, provides a rational basis for this uniformity. God upholds the world in an orderly way.
Right. And finally, he touches on the remarkable efficacy of mathematics. The seemingly inexplicable way in which abstract mathematical concepts so accurately describe and predict the behavior of the physical world.
Yes, this has been a source of wonder for scientists and philosophers for centuries. Why does mathematics, which seems like a product of human thought, map onto the structure of reality with such uncanny precision? Naturalism struggles to fully account for this profound connection.
But for the theist?
For the theist, it makes sense if both the universe and the human mind were created by the same intelligent designer who structured both in accordance with, perhaps, mathematical principles. Think about Einstein's deep confidence in his theories based purely on their mathematical elegance, even before empirical confirmation.
Yeah, he trusted the math.
Or just the practical example Dr. Spiegel uses. You can use geometry and math to figure out exactly how to cut pieces of wood to build something stable. Math works in the real world. Why? Theism offers a potential answer. God structured both the world and our minds to resonate with each other mathematically.
So, Plantinga is essentially arguing that the very foundations that make science possible, The reliability of our minds, the consistency of nature, the power of mathematics actually find a more coherent and robust grounding within a theistic worldview than within a purely naturalistic one.
That's the core of his argument, yeah. He's not suggesting that science and theism are never in tension at the level of specific theories, but that at a deeper philosophical level, they are surprisingly compatible, while the real underlying tension exists between science and the philosophical framework of naturalism itself.
Well, this deep dive has certainly given us a lot to chew on, and hopefully for you as well. It's clear that the relationship between science and religion is far more complex and nuanced than a simple head-to-head battle.
Definitely not simple.
There are numerous ways to understand their interaction, with compelling arguments on many sides.
And as Plantinga provocatively suggests, the most significant intellectual challenge might lie in a place we don't always expect, between science and naturalism.
So for you, the listener, we leave you with this. Take some time to reflect on your own fundamental assumptions about knowledge and truth. How do these different models we've discussed resonate with your understanding of the world and your place within it? What implications do these perspectives have for how we approach the pursuit of knowledge in all aspects of your life?
Yeah, good questions to ponder.
This deep dive is really just the beginning, and we encourage you to continue exploring these fascinating questions and to keep thinking critically about the world around you.